Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our Macon City Council meeting on February 24th. We're glad to have each and every one of you here. And as we go through our agenda, if you would like to speak on any of the items on the agenda, you certainly may. Just raise your hand, and we'll notice that and ask you to come up right over there. It looks a little different, but it works. And as we begin our meeting this evening, we'll start with council prayer and followed by Pledge of Allegiance.
May we pray. O God, our Heavenly Father, our Maker and our Sustainer, we come to you tonight with thanksgiving in our hearts, thanking you for bringing us through the storm, for being our shelter in the time of the storm. We're grateful that you blessed us with the opportunity to extend helping hands and show love to those that we may not even have known before. And we thank you for the friendships that we've made from this devastating experience. We thank you for our dedicated crews from our fair city and the linemen that traveled far and near, leaving their own families behind so that they could provide assistance to us. We ask that you continue to bless and keep us as we restore our city to the beauty that we all know. And as we discuss the business of the evening, we ask that you open our hearts that we might feel you, open our minds that we might know you, open our eyes so that we might see you in the faces of others. Help us to serve our community with sincerity and dedication. We ask your continued favor shown on our community as well as our dedicated staff. Help us to remember that all things work together for the good to those who serve you. We promise to acknowledge your gifts and praise in everything we do. In your precious name we pray. Amen.
Amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
First item of business this evening is the consideration of the minutes from the Horizons meeting of January 31st and February 1st and the regular meeting of February 10th, 2014. Do we have a motion and a second for approval?
So moved, Mr. Mayor.
I second.
Okay. Any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passage unanimously. Under presentations, our first presentation is Winter Storm PACS update, State of Emergency Resolution, and Land Use Agreement. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, thank you very much. As councils are aware, we have over 260 miles worth of roadways in the city of Aiken. And little did we know when we met back on the 10th, the storm that was brewing and on its way to visit us to bring over an inch of rain. I've had the opportunity to spend a great deal of time with staff, both in the middle of the storm and then with the storm's aftermath. As we sit here tonight, I'm happy to report that city crews have picked up over 12.5% of the total city's storm debris. Tim Coakley is here, is going to talk to you about our plan for picking up storm debris. We also have George Grinton here to talk about some of our utilities and the impact on some of our utility buildings and fences as a result of the storm. We did have an opportunity to sit down with FEMA officials on Friday, and this is an advanced team. As council is aware, we will not have a state of emergency and a disaster declared until the president signs off on that. We're encouraged that will happen within the next few weeks. After we hear the presentations tonight, we would ask that council declare a state of emergency in the city of Aiken. That'll help us with procurement. It'll also help us with the debris that we are handling as being handled within the state of emergency umbrella. But before we get to that point in the agenda tonight, first we'd like to hear from Director Charles Barranco about the various actions that Aiken Department of Public Safety has taken throughout this winter weather event. Is that what we wound up with, Chief?
Yes.
Take it away.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here before you tonight to talk to you about our preparation, the events itself, and the response that encountered. This is something that, of course, we don't deal with every day, and so preparation we thought was most important. Late Friday afternoon on the 7th, we began to get reports of this potential storm coming over in, and we monitored that over the weekend. But Monday, as you can see, it really began to look like it was bearing down on us. And so we wanted to take the time to prepare ourselves and the plans that we have in place, simple things such as equipment, recovering that from storage areas to establishing communication within the city and county and state levels, just to bounce information off of emergency management, seeing what the information they're getting. So we started those lines of communication early. Tuesday, preparations continued with making sure the four-wheel drive vehicles were available to us. We worked with other city departments to make that happen. Prepared the emergency operations center, and then started to adjust some of the schedules to make sure we had adequate staff during the event itself. And just a little timeline, of course, the first wave of storm starts to move across on Tuesday. On the 12th of Wednesday, the storm damage starts and increases hourly. The cold continues on the 13th, and it really, we could feel it very, very much so then. After the storm is still affecting the city today, as you can know. But on the 12th of, on Wednesday the 12th, that evening was the first emergency response that we as public safety responded to as a structure fire in the reserve at Woodside. And we found a hidden fire inside the wall. This was as a result of trying to heat your home with some gas logs. And so we felt like we would be responding to those different areas trying to, as far as heating units go. And we had three of those, and we'll talk about them in just a few minutes. But the first one was at the reserve. This was also as the icy conditions were at its height. This response, of course, we were very clear as staff to be careful on the way. We have to get there to be able to help people, and they were. The next morning, we had another incident out at Pine Acres Campgrounds where someone was using their fireplace. The fire became a little too big for the fireplace and extended outside there. And this was an elderly handicapped woman that was rescued from the fire by firefighters, and the fire was extinguished. Thursday as well, there was another rescue. This was on Bel Air Terrace off of Dibble Road. Of course, as you can imagine, the trees were still down at this time, and there was a response to an asthmatic patient on Bel Air Road. Well, trees were down in both directions. We contacted E&U and Public Services, and they sent two crews over. We also sent public safety officers by foot to the resident to be able to start assessing the patient, and had to cut substantial trees and push them to the side of the road to be able to get to the patient. She was successfully transported to the hospital. Friday morning, of course, we had another structure fire that was extended out of a fireplace, got into some cracks of the mortar of the fireplace and dripped down and started to a very sizable home. Crews responded, Ed did an excellent job to be able to extinguish the fire actually from underneath the house. And then, as you all felt, Friday evening was the earthquake, and we were inundated with phone calls trying to answer of what was that. You might have had the same concern, but quick response from the dispatch center. They were able to pull up on the website and find out it was, in fact, an earthquake, and we answered a bunch of calls, could not find any damage as a result of that. And then early Saturday morning, we responded to another structure fire. We believe was determined to be electrical. This displaced at least 10 people and six residents, or six apartments. This was significant fire damage to three of the apartments, and then three of the apartments had smoke and water damage. We were able to take the residents to our Smith Hazel Warming Center until the Red Cross could find them a place to stay. And then finally, on Saturday, we had another structure fire on Rosin Court, which we believe, again, was electrical in origin as the power started to come back on. The response, some additional things that we did, we began meeting daily early on with City Manager's Office, of course, Public Safety, PRT, Engineering, Utility, and Public Services, to communicate throughout the city the different needs and concerns everybody had. We did have extra fire personnel assigned to the engine companies. We expected downed trees, and those large apparatus weren't going to be able to get around to different areas. So we also put supply lines on the forestry trucks, the four-wheel drive trucks, to be able to have a response vehicle to fight fire. Out on the in the field, personnel prioritized response calls. We were able to send public safety officers to some of the down power lines to assess those situations without having to respond to fire truck, and because the roads were still dangerous. And then, you know, of course, we had additional staff on the streets throughout the event to help out the shifts as needed. As part of the response, the cooperation between the city departments was excellent. We met daily, as we talked about, but the communication as issues arose, we were able to address them in a very timely fashion. And later on in the presentation, we'll see one of the reasons we believe that was effective is the most recent upgrade to our radio systems, being able to turn right over or use a common channel to be able to talk on. And the rescue off of Dibble Road, we use that channel to be able to communicate throughout all the city crews, so it was very effective. We also used generators on the main intersections to keep those up and running. Of course, with the power outage, we were continuing to advise people to please stay inside and off the roads. Although the roads were clear, we still had a lot of power outages, and so and only one lane on some of the two-lane roads were clear, so it was just a concern for all of us to be able to have that emergency response. And then later on, as we the power needs decreased, we were able to reallocate some of the generators to neighborhoods that were still out of power, just to shed some light in the neighborhood, as well as some charging stations for a cell phone or a laptop or something to that effect. And then a summary, as you can imagine, our dispatch center was inundated. The week before, at Public Safety Headquarters, we had about 23,500 calls. The week of the storm was 10,000 calls in addition to what we normally expect. And then the 2 hours after the earthquake came in, we received over 3,000 calls came in the dispatch center. 300. We're talking about thousands of calls up here and then right to hundreds. It's 300 calls into the dispatch center. We had three dispatchers on duty, and additionally were called in at that time because we didn't know when the calls would slow down. It was about 2 hours there. Public Services and NEU supplied personnel at the dispatch center to answer calls and to help dispatch seamlessly the down lines and down limbs. We really think that was productive for the citizens to be able to get that to the appropriate authorities. And then, again, it talks about the recently acquired abilities to communicate across city staff. We think that has made a huge impact in the response to this storm. I thought this was a sort of a neat picture to share with you. The Sheriff's Office and Public Safety joined together to put those generators out in these neighborhoods, and just a cooperative effort, not only among city staff, but county agencies as well.
Thanks, Chief. we'll hold our questions. We've got three more presentations. Tim, could you talk to us next, please?
Sure. Thank you for letting me come before you tonight. The first 36 hours of my department was pretty much cutting the stuff and pushing it out of the roads. We were trying to keep the roads open as quick as they were coming down. We deployed every backhoe in both my department and George Britton's department, and everybody we had certified that could run a chainsaw was out there running them. So we were wide open. Many of my guys worked 20 to 22 hours the first day, slept for three or four and came back. So one of the big things that we had to do was assess the damage as we were going along, and I provided you in your package and I had a picture of our 2004 ice storm. We were trying to use that as a perspective on how much was out there, and actually met with a couple of the utility guys from SCE&G, you know, waiting for them to dead a line so we could cut it, and said, you know, John, how bad is it in the county? And they said 2 to 3 times as bad as the 2004 storm. So we were kind of using that as a reference to start with, and there's a the second page of that's a picture again. That was 100,000 cubic yards back in 2004, and it was about $1 million request to FEMA, and they refunded us $756,000 back in 2004. So we were still trying to gain a grasp of how big, how bad this is, damage assessment. Then we started cleaning it up after the first 36, and we deployed our crews to different parts of the city and began marking on a map, you know, what streets had been done. And we got with our GIS technician and said, hey, how hard would it be to put a polygon around these streets that we've done and measure them in acres? And she said, no problem. So she dropped some polygons around what we'd done, and that's how we calculated this 12% that the city manager told you about earlier tonight. We know the total acreage of the city. We know how many acres we've picked up in those polygons. All right. So we know we've completed 12% of the city. And to keep up with FEMA, we've got some very strict rules on how we have to pick this stuff up, and I just made a quick copy of some load tickets, but we have to list who picked it up and what street it came off of, and it actually has to be inspected by an inspector to make sure that the truck's completely full. And the next page is his list as he's checking them in at our drop site. But I thought what was really interesting in the list was the third column there with the time, how there's a truck coming past that inspector every 3 to 5 minutes, nonstop, all day long, hauling. And then on the last page is what we got together as a senior staff and met with FEMA and tried to come up with some type of way to logically forecast what was out there better than just, you know, we think it's 2 times bigger than 2004. We took those load tickets and totaled them up, and this is data as of Saturday night when we quit working, that we had hauled 14,872 cubic yards, and we knew that that was 12% of the city. So we set up a simple ratio and proportion and cross-multiplied and came up with a prediction of what was out in the city of 123,933 cubic yards. But that's what's out there right now. As soon as we go down these streets, more is coming out. So we're expecting a second and possibly a third pass to get it all picked up. The second pass, we diminished the percentage to 75% of that original number, and the third pass, we diminished it down to 50%. And we added those three passes up and came up with a total projected cubic yardage of 278,850 cubic yards out there. So the SCE&G lineman that said it was 2 to 3 times as bad early in the storm was pretty close to being accurate. So one thing I'd like to tell you is we've received some mutual aid from several other cities. We had a crew down here from the city of Rock Hill helping us. We had three crews from Lexington, a crew from Springdale, a crew from Clinton, and two crews from Greenwood that are assisting us in picking this stuff up. So we're throwing everything at it that we've got.
And you had an offer from the city of Greenville that we helped out in 2006.
That's right. In 2006, they had a pretty significant ice storm, and we sent crews up there for about a month and helped them get through their first pass. And that's what these other cities are helping us do, is try to get through ours.
Yeah. Thank you, George. Yeah.
Good evening. I took that picture myself during the storm on Tuesday morning, I think it was. It's actually pretty if you didn't see all the destruction that occurred. But, what we did, as the others have said, preparation. What we did was get our pump stations, our water tanks, everything ready. We filled our water storage tanks to the maximum so that if we did lose power wherever we had elevated tanks, they would at least provide pressure and water to the city. We made sure that all our generators, pump around stations were operational, fully fueled. We obtained salt from SCDOT. We do have an agreement that whenever there's a storm event like that, SCDOT does provide salt to municipalities. So we had our dump trucks, our two dump trucks and our two flatbed trucks filled with salt so that we'd be able to put that down on the main thoroughfares. We organized our emergency crew into 12-hour, 24-hour coverage assignments, and that included operators, dispatchers, and equipment. And we actually distributed some of the equipment we had strategically around the city. We knew that we didn't want to have to be bringing everything from Kershaw Street over roads that might be hard to pass, so we kind of looked at north, south, east, west quadrant of the city and then strategically located on city property where it would be available for the crews to span out. And then we waited for the storm. When the storm hit, we actually divided our crews and combined them with public safety personnel. Public safety, or public services, I should say, has tree removal equipment. We have the heavy equipment. We have lots of people. We have lots of the operators. And so combining the two together made sense so that it could be coordinated and then dispatched from one location. The utility dispatchers we had actually went to the Emergency Operations Center to help with the dispatchers take those extra 10,000 calls. They also then could call to the public services dispatcher so that then we could send out the crews to the locations. Our dispatchers pretty well know where the, you know, if there were utility issues or our people or what equipment we have. It was just a very efficient way to help public safety and to better coordinate with public services. So that's some of the cooperation and coordination that both Tim and the chief were talking about.
Not to interrupt you, George, but that was something we tried for the first time, and it worked very,
yes,
very well. That took a lot of the load off of dispatch because they could transfer the call then go to the emergency calls. And
yeah,
we felt that really helped us.
Being side by side like that, I think, was real key. For the first 24, 36 hours, we focused on street clearing and salting of the bridges. The priority was to keep the main routes to the city clear and to have access to the hospitals, and that's what we focused on.
Our road grader crew was Phil Burley and Harvey Stone. They scraped those roads all night long. Never stopped. Constantly.
If they kept moving, the ice couldn't accumulate faster than we were moving it. So just to get one lane through each way was the objective on the big roads, and one lane through everywhere else. Power was lost intermittently on Wednesday, so our crews spent a lot of time visiting our affected stations, both water and the sanitary sewer pump stations, just restarting pumps and motors. Wednesday evening was when we started losing power to most of the city, and at that point we started the main stations. We have five big lift stations. We started the generators and pumps, as well as Town Creek. We kept a well and a booster pump running in the south side because we don't have elevated tanks. We have to keep a booster pump running if you're going to maintain pressure. So then the water crews started also having to move the generators to the water tanks where our SCADA systems are. We have a system where we can see what the status of all the pumps and motors are going on, but we have to have small generators keeping the power going to those small systems, so we deployed some of those. That was a key. The pump station crews then started moving our portable generators and pump arounds to the highest flow sanitary sewer lift stations so that we could pump down the wet wells and maintain anything from going over. So we had we were going back and forth between the different wells that based on what we know is the rate at which they'll fill up. On Thursday, we obtained three additional portable pump arounds from Charleston, and we put those on the highest flow lift stations that did not have backup equipment. And we obtained one generator from Atlanta. So we had four more stations now of the higher flows that we could keep something situated, and then we could move our other ones around. On Friday, we obtained three vacuum tankers from Columbia. And what we did there was, because we had so many stations that were still out, they're small, low flow, but they're still filling up. So we actually had these vacuum trucks, and they went around and they vacuumed the wet wells, and then we transported it to the stations where we had the emergency power running and emptied it, and then went back to another one and filled it, and so we just kept doing a circuit. Power started coming back Friday night, Saturday, so we had one tanker on Saturday employed, and then by Sunday we were able to just move the generators to the locations that no longer had, still had no power, and that worked well. So the aftermath, we cleared debris from the right-of-way access to the stations. We cleaned the pump station overflows. We did have eight stations that had relatively minor overflows. There were two larger, six minor, and reported that to DHEC as we were supposed to, and we cleaned up the areas, and then we continue even today to provide our equipment and our personnel to public services as they are still going about and will be for a while. Removing the debris and disposing of it.
And we'll open up for questions after yep. Glenn has a chance to present.
Initially just walk you through a few photos and show you sort of what we're seeing out there. The first picture you're seeing is Hopelands and Rye Patch, and Mr. Pierce, Tom Rapp, Lisa Hall, and I had the opportunity last week to walk through. And you hear the old adage, sometimes it looks like a bomb went off. It looks like a bomb went off. Trees are down everywhere. We don't know how. We don't think any buildings in Hopelands was damaged. We got big trees laying right beside it, but our priority in PRT, it shifted to, we knew we had events coming up. So, you know, we looked at our calendar, we started calling people. We had a mother who had a rehearsal party in there this past Saturday night. We took on the mode of trying to help these folks to so they could continue with their normal life. And we started calling around. We found her somewhere to have a rehearsal party. So she moved it. We've moved a couple of things around. Some of you, if you haven't, you'll be invited. We've got the Horse of the Year celebration coming up March 16th. We'll be recognizing the Horse of the Year, Palace Malice, and we've moved that already. So things are just at a standstill right now. Mr. Ebner asked me this morning if we could guarantee Hopelands would be clean by the first concert, and that's in May. And I said, yes, May we can guarantee. Anything before that, no promises. But you can see, you know, the bottom right's Oak Alley. We're probably going to have to get a special crew with a lot of buckets to go in Hopelands to take care of that. It's just a lot of stuff hanging in Hopelands right now. Very little structural damage, though. You see that fence on the right, that took a little bit of damage. Citizens Park took a pretty good hit. The fence that you see down on your bottom right, that's at our original complex, Field 5. It's the biggest field we have out there. It's the largest fence we have out there. We've already gotten an estimate on replacing that. We've gotten some bid specs we're drawing up now to get that done. And we're also trying to evaluate, because this is the one where there's money in the capital project sales tax to redo this fall. So hopefully whatever we do now to fix it, you know, we can go ahead and be planning for what we're going to do this fall. Tim mentioned the debris pile a little bit from 2004. Top left, I took a picture of where the debris pile is now, early before they started bringing in their debris, and I'll show you a timeline in just a minute, but you can already see a pile starting to accumulate out there. The bottom left is the Woodward House, where our office is, and it really took a hit. A lot of the large trees in it were down. A lot of our neighborhood parks, this is just an example at Eustace Park, a lot of our neighborhood parks took hits. We didn't lose any equipment. Fortunately, we had some fence damage at Perry Park and at the Crossing Park, but otherwise, we're in pretty good shape there. Smith Hazel was a shining star through all of this. I don't know how it happened. Those of you that were around in 2004, you may remember that Smith Hazel was one of the only places in 2004 that had power. And we served as a warming center then, and we did the same thing here. And I'll get into the timeline in just a minute, but the folks laying there, maximum we had about 75, 80 folks in there one night. We were in the gym floor. We brought aerobics mats. People were feeding them, volunteers. A lot of you know Betty Giles. I think Betty spent 2.5 days before we made her go home. Just people came out, and the spirit in there was so good in Smith Hazel. Tri-Development was without power till I think Saturday, or I've got it in the timeline, but Tri-Development spent the entire time with us. Here's sort of our timeline. Staff prepped on that Tuesday, that Wednesday we were closed. As Mr. Pierce mentioned, we staffed that motor grader from 9 p.m. Wednesday to 9 a.m. Thursday morning. And one of the things to keep in mind with that is we had another vehicle following behind that motor grader just to provide sort of a buffer, to ride shotgun, if you will, to keep those folks safe. Our staff started being called in about 10:30 that morning. I think on Thursday was our biggest day, and we had about 50 folks from PRT on the ground helping clean up that day. Smith Hazel opened that night as a warming station, and the first night we only had three or four people. On Thursday, as you can see, we were up to 55 from Tri-Development, and we had about 25 others who were just without power. One of the things, I don't know if Tim or who made the decision, but when they sent our crews out, they told us, go to Woodside and just take care of it. And I think one of the things that eliminated is George mentioned the phone calls coming in. What that did was keep us off the radio, because if they just had a small pile, someone was calling in, they didn't have to call us and, you know, stay on the radio. They had told us to take care of Woodside, and when we took care of that, the next day we moved into Hounds Lake, then we moved into Jim Lakes and Town Creek. So my crews through PRT sort of took that area of town and worked through that. It was very interesting on Friday. As y'all know, the weather was starting to warm up. People were hitting the walking tracks and the walking trails, and we had to go out and make sure those were safe for everybody. Saturday, the week center opened. We were ready to go. The debris station at Pine Log and Centennial was opened on Saturday. That has been designated for city residents who can bring their debris to Pine Log and Centennial. We're trying to keep the pile at Citizens Park just for our bigger city crews to go in and out of, and that's worked very well. We kept a person there basically 7 days a week just pushing that pile and keeping it as compact as we can. Again, Sunday, Smith Hazel with a large group. Monday, we started to reopen. All of our programs started to reopen. Something that was, I may have missed it somewhere in here, but baseball registration is right now. We were getting so many phone calls. Are we going to get an extension on baseball? Gary Smiley, he can appreciate this. But we had to extend baseball a little bit for those folks who wanted to make sure they didn't miss that coming up this spring. A real highlight, Thursday night, Monday night at 8 o'clock, we closed up Smith Hazel and we sent everybody home. And they were very appreciative, Tri-Development was, and the other folks were, being able to use that facility.
Well, thank you very much. Stuart, can we just move that placard back? And again, as I said, we sat down with the FEMA advance team on Friday. We presented this information and other information as well. As of today, we've issued 54 business licenses for folks that have come into the area to work on cleanup. When we sat down with FEMA, there's a new pilot program, and we're looking at the feasibility of the city participating in it after Katrina, after the storm up in New Jersey. They have a pilot project that reimburses at a higher rate if you clean up your debris in 30 days, a next higher rate in 60 days, and then a third tier for what you clean up within 90 days. All of these levels are higher than their standard 75% reimbursement. We've made amazing progress with the out-of-town companies. Tim's crew have just been admirable. Glenn, your folks and their willingness to go out into Woodside and the other neighborhoods on the south side. Plus, I just can't sing enough high praises about Phil Burley and Harvey Stone keeping those roads open Wednesday night when everything was just going very, very badly and continued to get worse. I know made a major difference in our ability not only to get around the cleanup, but to make sure emergency vehicles have their access. We set up in the EOC. We did not activate the EOC because staff was staying on top of it. And, of course, the sheriff issued his directive that vehicles stay off the road. So, you know, we tried to stay in touch with council and provided about a dozen different updates. The folks at FEMA were very complimentary about our documentation and record keeping so far. With 12% of the first pass done, we believe that Tim's estimates, and I think FEMA really validated that in the room on Friday, Tim, that an estimate that we have about 277,000 cubic yards of debris to pick up is a very good estimate, something we're going to work off of. With the damages that we have, with the overtime we're paying, with the crews that we fed, with the lift stations being without power and the remedial measures we've had to take, with the additional equipment we've brought in, and in several other areas, we're very comfortable that we have about a $2 to $3 million effort in the city limits. I sat down with our finance director, and we've taken a look at our reserves. And depending on our success and the participation with the pilot program, we believe we have adequate reserve funds on hand to handle the expenses that we'll have to cover as our share. We were very fortunate back in 2004 with that ice event that FEMA reimbursed at 75%. And the state of South Carolina stepped up at another 12.5%. Along with the FEMA advance team, we had a representative from the South Carolina Emergency Management Department, and they're not making any commitments at this point about any percentage reimbursement. So we'll keep council informed, and we may actually need assistance with contacting the state and encouraging them through our legislative delegation to make a full reimbursement so that we don't suffer any unnecessary impacts to our budget. At this time, I didn't know if council had some questions. I do have a couple of action items that we would ask council.
I do. I've got a couple of questions. First of all, I want to say thank you. Thank you for your leadership and the superb job that you did. I was out and about quite a bit myself, and it was wonderful to see the working together. That is so important in anything we do, but to see how you work together. Question: did we have any city staff or employee injuries?
I'm aware of just some minor injuries, some pinched fingers and that kind of thing.
Nothing serious.
Nothing we would classify as a serious injury.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I'm sure that there have got to be some lessons learned. Since a lot of folks weren't here in 04, could each one of you say you've got lessons to learn that would improve the next time? And I'm sure that's the case, but thank you again for all you did and for our city. Appreciate it.
I'd like to say that I'm impressed with the preparation that you made before the storm. I'm thankful for the response during the storm. And I know God knows it could have been much worse than it was. But we came through. Again, we proved that we go on. We pull together and we go on. And that's what all of those departments did. We pulled together and we're going on. I thank you.
Tim, I have a question. As you're coming around to clean up the neighborhoods, I see some really good-sized logs that are out there, and I see some very long branches. Can I assume those trucks will have the capability to chainsaw, cut some of the longer branches? Because people aren't doing the 4 feet that we would like them to do. They're just getting them out there.
Absolutely. Every truck we've got out there that's loading has got a chainsaw in the truck and a certified operator.
And will you have the capability of taking the big logs?
Oh, yeah. Those things will pick it up.
Okay.
It's certainly helpful, though, if the citizens could help us and do the 4 foot length.
Hey, so I can show you. 1006 Bell Reeve, they're 4 feet.
Good job. I wish I could say the same for 107 Quaker Ridge Road.
The truck's strong enough, but the 4 foot length helps us from banging them into mailboxes. And
you're going to use the one with the winch?
The grapple truck.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Mayor, I have several questions. The location of the debris, been asked a number of times, what do we plan to do with all of this debris?
Actually, Stuart Beedbow has helped us with that. Ms. Price, as our purchasing agent, we're in conversations with several vendors that, depending on our ability to chip the debris up, they would be interested in purchasing it. We've talked with contractors at the site, as well as some folks in the vicinity in the Augusta-Newberry area. So we're already having that discussion.
Okay. The second question deals with the business license. You've mentioned, Mr. Pierce, that we've issued 54.
Yes.
Are these small businesses, large businesses, and are they in this? I know some out of town, but do we have a representative number that's within the city limits?
Yeah, and that's a real good question. I think the majority of folks without a business license have been out of area. And we've had folks from as far away as Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Texas, Florida, and all points in between. But I'm happy to see, as I ride around town, that our local tree services are out in force and they're working very hard.
Okay. And the third question, Chief, deals with your comment regarding the thousands of phone calls. I know you had people working all kinds of hours, long hours. Did we bring in how many shift hours did they work? And secondly, what would you say most of the calls were related to?
Good question. We've estimated about 300 hours of overtime for public safety only. And I'd like to take this opportunity, and I know they're here not for this, but Bennett Tucker and Jason Rayburn are in the audience, and they're two of our volunteers.
Wow.
Who spent the night at Station 2 and additional calls. So thank you guys for your assistance. Really, the shift works, we just adjusted schedules so we didn't have to accrue all that additional overtime.
Okay. But most of the calls were related to various things, power?
Limbs, power lines. When the power started coming back on, there were concerns about if they're, their house. And so we would go and look at it and help out when there were some concerns of lights flashing.
Okay.
And you had calls for assistance for safety checks, wellness checks on senior citizens, transportation to move senior citizens around. And it was rather fortunate that those are the calls we had of incidents of crime occurring went way down. So we were able to help with providing service.
We got transported a good many to Smith Hazel and to relatives that could help take care of them.
Okay. I wondered how they managed to get to their destination given the power outage and the elderly impacted as well.
Well, of course, we didn't want anybody on the road, so we were helping them get to where they needed to be.
Safely.
Yes,
ma'am.
I'd also like to thank y'all for clearing the route for the Black History Parade on Saturday. I passed that direction on early Friday morning, and I thought there's no way they're going to be able to pull this off. And about a quarter to five on Friday evening, my daughter told me, she said, Mama, you may want to come around another direction to get home because they're clearing the debris for the parade. So I thank you. That meant a lot to a lot of people.
You're welcome. And we got with our tourism director, Elizabeth Harm, mm-hmm. and she's given us a list of dates that we're going to try to hit. You know, upcoming, we've got the horse races coming up. We're deployed in that area strongly this week, trying to get ahead of the roads and all the traffic that's going to be down in there.
I had an opportunity to meet with Tim's crew 6 o'clock Saturday morning, mm-hmm. and the street sweeper was out at 4 a.m. to make sure that that route was
swept. Tim and Mary offered to come in.
It looked good. You did well.
Thank you.
Richard, with regard to overtime, I know it's sometimes been our policy to ask people to take comp time instead of getting paid for the overtime. I really hope we don't do that. I hope we can find a way to put you at ease.
Hmm? We're paying overtime.
Good.
This go around.
That's a much more serious event. Yes, absolutely, because people are doing a lot of hard work and
they really are.
They want to see that fat paycheck.
Several of them mentioned that in the field, Mr. DeWalt.
I'm sure they did. Well, I think it's our job to support them in that case.
Absolutely. And that is FEMA reimbursable. We're very anxious to get the presidential declaration because that kind of helps guide us on our path forward. But we knew we had a mess. And, you know, the threshold for the entire county is about $500,000. And I'm sure that as it stands right now that the city of Aiken is going to be between $2 and $3 million easily.
I know that it takes patience and this kind of effort. But Tim, any sort of speculated time frame as to when we have most of it done? And Richard, given what you've said in terms of FEMA involved, I don't know what can we expect. And I know that I'm not putting you on the spot and holding you to the date if you say maybe we'll have all this cleared. But
I knew we were going to probably get this question tonight. I really don't know. It changes every day.
Okay.
You know, we think we've set up the perfect team and scenario, and then we move into a different neighborhood, and it's just a different kind of debris or it's stacked differently. I would predict the first pass through the city to service every resident one time. It's going to take us about a month.
Okay. That's realistic. Okay.
And seeing as we've only done 12% in the first week, we're behind schedule. We're not hitting that.
True, but, I mean, it's not a straight line. You're getting better each day. So the numbers went up significantly as the week progressed. And, of course, with the other cities appearing and providing support, some of those cities were packing 10 to 12 trailers a day. And, you know, when you talk to folks in the debris removal business, that's a lot of trailers in a day. I mean, they were not sitting around. They've been working.
You're exactly right. We get better every day as we learn what configurations of equipment work better.
My husband saw one of your trucks picking the debris up. And he was fast, and he said, I'd like to play with that thing. I said, no, it's not the kind of thing we want you to play with.
He'll sign a waiver.
We'll
think about it.
But anyway, you've done an exceptional job, and we appreciate the time and effort with your entire staff. Thank you so much.
And last question. Will utility companies more than likely send letters of appreciation and thanks to the states that provided us assistance? I know we had a group from Kentucky in our neighborhood, and they did a great job.
You did. Was that the Pike crew, PIC?
I don't know which one it was, but we gave them an ovation as they left the neighborhood after restoring power.
And I'm glad you brought that up, Mr. DeWar, because as folks have put signs out, you know, thank you, power company, you've seen those signs.
Yeah.
We had a chance Saturday morning to kind of talk about some of the things that happened throughout the week, and we've had citizens that have come out with, you know, their children with bags of cookies and bottled water and Gatorade. I'm not saying folks have to do that. I'm saying folks have done that. And Charlie Hartz is in the audience, and I patronized him last Monday morning. I paid for it, Charlie. Monday morning and Saturday morning this week, and we did donuts and coffee for the crews. And I have to say that these folks have got to be tired, but they don't act tired. They're very excited. They're very much unified in having this common goal of cleaning up their city. That's the whole mindset, and it's it's inspiring. I'll just tell you, it's very inspiring. These folks know what they need to do, and they're committed to get it done.
Well, there were so many people that played in this in terms of partnership, the hotels especially, and accommodating all these crews
yes.
that were coming in, and
yes.
other folks that were opening their doors to have these folks have a place to stay and lay their heads. So it's a team effort.
Chief, question, if I may. Chief?
Yes, sir.
With a lot of the lights out from time to time at the intersections, I didn't see any accidents. But were there some accidents?
There were a few accidents, but for the most part, we just advise people to treat an intersection with no power as a four-way stop.
Yeah, right. I know that.
That was very helpful to get out, and we appreciate the citizens' cooperation with that.
How many accidents would you say you saw?
I don't know that. I can call that number for
no,
you.
No, it's okay. It doesn't matter. I don't think it was
we didn't have very many.
Significantly less than what we could have had.
Yes, sir. Yes. And really less than what we do on a normal day of operation. So.
We don't recommend an ice storm for traffic control. We're
yeah,
not recommending that.
That was mostly because of the low volume of traffic that's on the road.
Right. Thank you. Anyone else?
We appreciate the daily alerts.
I hope that was helpful to you.
Very helpful to
you. I mean, it's such a significant event. Mm-hmm. You know, when I sent out and told you there were 48,000 folks out of power, then it occurred to me to ask, well, how many accounts do you have? They have 52,000. So, I mean, that's a significant event by any measure.
So we appreciate
Phillip
it.
Phillip
said
he's got a question.
Just comment.
I just had 2 cents. We talked about leadership and inspiration, and there are a lot of memories from this ice storm, but three of the most significant was on Thursday morning, as we all woke up to see the level of damage and devastation, I walked down South Boundary, and the first vehicle making the first set of tracks weaving through South Boundary had Chief Branco and Richard Pierce in it. Early Thursday morning, and as I ventured out, and ultimately that same Thursday morning went down the bypass, the Hitchcock Parkway, as I made the curve, just go down the hill, I saw off in the distance somebody wearing their OSHA vest dragging a tree off of the Hitchcock Parkway by themselves. As I got closer, I realized it was none other than Glenn Parker, who's the director of Parks and Rec, and he was out there with a chainsaw, single-handedly pulling a tree off. And so, inspired by Glenn, I oversaw a tree laying across Greg Avenue, my son and I, and so we got out of the car and proceeded to try to take that tree off of Greg Avenue. And two police officers and a public service truck pulled up immediately, told us to stop. And we tried not to stop, and they said if we didn't stop, they'd arrest us. but nevertheless,
that was the county, I'm sure. That was not the city.
But, I mean, the leadership and the inspiration is truly there. I'm very proud of what you guys did. You know, we had no role in it. You guys did it all, but I'm really grateful.
Philip, I have to add, too, that Glenn Parker had a tree on his house, so he had, like, personal damage. Tim Coakley's wife woke up and had a tree limb 18 inches from her nose. And they nevertheless came out and were on the job, and I have to brag on city staff to the person. Everybody was ready to work, committed, focused, and the interdepartmental cooperation I'll put up against any other city in the state of South Carolina. Excellent job, fellas. We do have a couple of action items. First is a resolution that I have on page 110 of the agenda packet. It's to declare the emergency and allow us to make emergency purchases.
Mm-hmm.
We are keeping up with those purchases, and we'll provide updates with council at subsequent council meetings, so you have that. So we would need a motion and second and a vote to approve the resolution.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second.
I'll move that we approve the resolution, Mr. Mayor.
I second.
Okay, discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor?
Passes unanimously.
Thank you. That's very helpful to us. As part of our debris collection and in abundance of precaution, we've been approached by the principals of Palmetto Pride Trust, LLC. That's Ken Ingram, Chad Ingram, Chase Ingram, and Clay Ingram. They have it's a total 30-acre tract. We've got the plat up on the screen for you to have a look at. That's great, Sarah. Of that northern portion, most of it's wooded, but there's approximately 20 acres of usable space with that and the other two smaller parcels there on Powder House Road. It's actually south of Steeplechase Track and Lisa Handy's veterinary office. It's also north of what used to be called the Reader Corporation. I think it's Arbor Reader. Arbor. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, David Jameson's got the name.
It's got a new name now.
Right, new name now. But in any event, they've offered to lease this space to us on a temporary basis for any overflow debris that we need to store. Again, only City of Aiken vehicles will use this space once we fill up the location on Old Airport Road at Citizens Park. And the Inghams are very willing to be paid the FEMA approved rate. I had hoped to have that rate for council tonight. I do not have that, but it would be the FEMA reimbursed rate. We have talked with them, and they're doing the research for us, but it's not in their rate schedule. So we would ask for a council approval for entering into this land use agreement, which starts at page 111 of your agenda packet.
Okay, do we have a motion and a second for approval?
So moved, Mr. Mayor.
Second.
All right, discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Okay. Does that take care?
It does. We actually had a request from SCDOT regarding a mutual agreement to work with them. We are not going to recommend entering that agreement at this time, based on some subsequent conversations I had with DOT officials after we sent out the agenda packet.
Okay. Right. Mr. Mayor, one thing I would, with my past experience on emergencies, you might want to, us would suggest that you have the our HR director read the current labor laws, because as you get FEMA and these others involved, somebody's going to ask the question, did you check your labor laws and everything? And it's always good to say, yes, I read them, and then you don't have to make an excuse, because I've had to do that before. So it might be something that the city manager, just have the HR manager just thumb through it, and then you can truthfully answer, yes, I did check all the laws and the Davis-Bacon and everything.
Right, and I'm not sure that Davis-Bacon applies necessarily, because, as I said, we're in-house doing the work. But Mr. Beatmo,
you have contractors, though.
So far, we have no contract.
You don't have?
Well, no, we're not going out. The county has and the state has. We have not.
All right, so all of these out-of-town contractors are all county?
No, sir. They're not county. They're city. City of Greenwood, City of Clinton, City of Lexington, City of Springdale, and we're going to the City of Greenville this week.
All right, so all the private haulers, who is hiring them and paying them, then the county?
The state and the county have
the county
private vendors they've gone with. And I have to say publicly, too, that these other cities have been very clear that they will accept the FEMA reimbursement as full payment. I mean, they want to help us. We've helped them, but they want to help us.
I think appreciate you doing that, because 6 months from now, a lot of times people forget what they said they would do.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We're working on that. And again, we're studying the pilot program. We're also, we have auditors and folks that are keeping up inventory as far as anything that we're purchasing.
Very good. Thank you, Reggie, for that comment. Moving on to item two, the bill, an entrepreneurial incubator.
Yes, sir.
We're happy to have the folks here today. Richard, would you like to?
Yes, sir. Katie Sachs is here. She and her dad, David Sachs, have entered into a venture at the corner of Park Avenue and Lawrence Street, and it's very exciting. Folks from the Chamber and University of South Carolina Aiken and I have met with preparations for opening the mill, and Katie, take it away. You've got a lot more to say.
Thank you. I first want to thank you all for having me here today and giving me the opportunity to present the mill on park to you. As you might know, we're right across the street from this municipal building. We're at the corner of Park and Lawrence, so it's happening right here in the heart of downtown Aiken. So what I'm going to do is first kind of go through and tell you a little bit about what the project's all about, and then talk about some of the partnerships we've formed, and then give you an update on the status of the construction when we hope to open and those sorts of things, just so you all are aware of what's happening right here in downtown Aiken. Some of this I'm going to breeze through just so I don't take up too much time, but there were several trends both nationally and locally that we studied. We had the influence of other groups as well. I know that the city, this is something that you guys have thought about as well. It's in the strategic plan. The chamber has focused on it in terms of their focus on economic vitality this year. And so not only are these national trends, but they're also local trends. But some of those things include more efficiently used office space, areas for expansion, contraction. People are very sensitive to overhead costs and that sort of thing, especially right now as the we're recalculating from the recession. And these are hopefully useful tools that will help us get people back to work, maybe get businesses off the ground, and support them. So just as a summary of the project, it is mostly half of it is traditional office space. The first floor is traditional office space. But the whole second floor is dedicated to micro offices and incubator space for growing or startup businesses. The idea for the second floor and what makes it a little bit different than what traditional office space is that the tenants who would be in the building would only lease the amount of space they need to do their work that they are going to spend 80% of their time doing, and everything else is shared. So even down to the kitchen and the bathroom facilities and the copy center and internet services and any other type of amenity or utility you might have in a traditional office, you actually share that amongst the other growing small businesses that are, you know, maybe floundering a little bit to get their feet underneath them and get going and get growing. This is at the corner of Park and Lawrence, as I mentioned before. There's 145 feet of frontage on Park Avenue and 211 feet on Lawrence Street. It's a 17,000 square foot building, and it's situated between two historic buildings that we want to be very conscious of, especially as we redevelop the facade and that sort of thing, work with the city on that. There's also 52 parking spaces on site, so I think on the day-to-day basis it's great for our tenants, but it's also something that we would hopefully be able to open up for any public user during the weekends or after hours and that sort of thing. As the building existed before construction started, it was pretty much a blank building. It was very dated. It was built in the 80s, and not a whole lot had happened there since. The configuration of the upstairs was not in a condition where it was easy to bring in another use. We really wanted to salvage as much of the building as we possibly could. We reused walls. We reused corridors. We did have to do some reconfiguration. But for the most part, we tried to repurpose most of what existed in the building already. This just kind of shows you proximity. Again, this is some positive features there. It's right downtown. It's nearby all the existing restaurants and retailers. We hope that having a concentration of office users that are there during the day maybe would linger at night. This is going to be a place that might have anywhere between 70 and 80 people working in this office at any given time. Currently, there's about 33 people working on the first floor. The second floor will bring in another 30 to 50 people, depending on the size of the businesses that we have come in. This is a little bit about the zoning. I really appreciated reading the zoning code for what we had here to work with. And the language that the city chose to describe this type of business, but because these are things that I believe in very strongly. First of all, its focus is on the commercial and civic functions in the city. In a compact area, it tends to be walking scale. It's a place that you could go, and you can also be able to go and visit a bunch of other things, have people come to you, go to other places. And I think those things help create activity in the city that are very necessary for vitality and vibrancy. And again, the integration of retail, service, entertainment, government, and residential uses. Pretty much every single thing on that list besides residential we hope to integrate into this site, and I'll get a little bit more into that in the next slides. And then I'd like to go into the local trends. The city, of course, you guys have thought about it through your strategic plans and other things that you've worked on. The Chamber has been very focused on this. This was a hot topic at the Blue Ribbon panel I served on the as a panelist this summer. And this was kind of a reoccurring theme we heard from the Greenville. Greenville has done a similar project to this. It's called Next. It's quite a bit larger than this building, but it was very inspiring to see what other cities are doing to foster the same type of development and growth in businesses. Aiken Young Professionals, they've talked about this, having something that's fun, a little bit different. Maybe it's somebody who wants to open a business but can't afford traditional office space downtown, so hopefully it might get some younger people as entrepreneurs getting going. And also the quality of life, having another opportunity to have a mix of use, have an activity. I'll get a little bit more into that later, but green space specifically, having somewhere to go and sit and enjoy being outside and maybe some free entertainment. And then connecting the downtown and the Aiken community to USC Aiken. The university is only, it's a little bit over 3 miles away from downtown, but I've experienced this, and I don't know how many others have, but there's a psychological separation between the university and Aiken. We are a college town. We have two colleges in Aiken, but it doesn't always feel that way. So I think this, we are forming a partnership with USC Aiken, which I'll get into in a little bit, but I think this is a very important element and critical to the success of the mill. And also the Small Business Development Center. They're also a key element here. National trends, and I'm not going to go through all of this, but basically streamlining in the mobile workforce. People are out, they're interacting with other people, they're on their cell phones, they're in their cars, they're not always at their desk. People don't need the large executive offices that they once did, and the trends are going, as you can see here, up to 40 to 60% of the time, desks are empty. So why pay a lot of money for a desk that stays empty most of the time? Also, adaptability. This is built in a way that as trends change and as demand changes, will provide the flexibility to change the spaces inside. If right now we're seeing a lot of one- and two-person businesses that are most interested in the mill and being in the mill. And, as they grow, they might be hiring on more employees, and we want to create the space that's highly adaptable so we can accommodate a growing business or a changing business or a new businesses that might come in that fills the place of someone who's left. There's also going to be space in the mill that will be more of the traditional incubator space. It will be co-working space, open desks. These are places where that interaction with amongst other businesses are really encouraged. This is something that the university and the Small Business Development Center has been very active in pursuing, and maybe even getting some recent college grads in a place where they can share some workspace, work at a desk, be in a professional environment, have a conference room to go have a professional presentation, and get a business up and running before moving into what would be a private office. So the results of these trends kind of narrowed us down to what we're planning to offer, and these are the micro-office suites, which are basically what you would see in any corporate office, but they're all different businesses. So it might just be a one-room office that might house one or two people. It might be a two-room office that houses two or four people. I think we'll see businesses anywhere from one person up to maybe 10-person offices at the mill, and that I'm sure will adapt and change as the years go by. This co-working and shared desks for emerging entrepreneurs. So these are really your true startups. They don't have a lot to work with. They're really trying to get going. These are going to be really short-term leases, so they might only have a desk on a weekly or monthly basis. but it gives them that flexibility and ability to come in, not feel pressured by a 3 or 5 year lease that you'd find in a traditional office space, to test the waters, test a model, whatever it might be, maybe get some funding, that sort of thing. And then the community of the office, this is very community driven. Every single square inch of common space in the building is geared towards encouraging interactions amongst the businesses. So as I actually work in an office where I share a floor with another small business, and we bounce ideas off of each other all the time. They happen to be a publication, they'll come in and run by, what, you know, by looking at this picture, what, how does that make you feel? What experience are you having when you read this article? And I think those are the things that are important when you're trying to get going. You don't know exactly what direction you're heading, and you can bounce ideas off other businesses. So anyone who might be in a micro office would be anyone who wants a small space. They might be a startup. They might be a larger firm trying to downsize and save some overhead. They might have too much. We've actually seen a little bit of that, where people had wasted space. They weren't using it. They weren't making the most of the money that they were spending. The introduction of a branch office or a project team that might be coming in from elsewhere and needs a landing spot for a short period of time, maybe it's 6 months, to have a professional space, do some business in Aiken, maybe move back, maybe stay for, you know, a couple more years. And then the co-working space, of course, these are going to be travelers or project teams, people who might work at home normally but would prefer a professional space but don't really have the money to spend it. These might be true startups or freelancers and networkers. And then back to the community. This is a place that we want to encourage this interaction. I'll go into this in a little bit, but we have the concept of opening a coffee shop, restaurant, that sort of thing. This is a place that would become what I like to call the third place. I don't know if you've heard that before, but you have your home, you have your work, and the third place is the place you just really like to be. And so we're hoping that this place will be that hub of activity, have event space, maybe a Saturday market, whatever it might be, right in the heart of downtown Aiken, right at one of the most prominent intersections. I don't know if we just have just a second. I have our main strategic partnerships that we've formed have been with the University of South Carolina Aiken and the Small Business Development Center. These partnerships were formed basically by happenstance. As I said before, there were a lot of converging trends locally. One of those were several different groups trying to accomplish the same thing. So I was looking at several pieces of property, and I saw this one, and I had studied this type of model, and I started putting a little business plan together, and actually David Jameson kind of knew, he knows everything, so he kind of knew what was going on, but he also knew that the university and the Small Business Development Center were interested in doing the same thing, and actually Aiken Downtown Development Association put us in contact with the Small Business Development Center, and we decided to meet and exchange our ideas and see how in line our visions were. And it was funny because we were sitting there at this first presentation, and we were kind of mirroring each other's conversation. Everything they said, you know, was a follow-up to what we had thought about, and they aligned perfectly. So we decided to explore what it would take to get a project up and running that was like this, not only successful but authentic. We really wanted to accomplish what our mission was to get out there and get businesses started in Aiken and that sort of thing. And Dr. Priest is here from the university, and Laura DeSanto is here from the Small Business Development Center. And I'm sure they'll be happy to answer any questions if anyone has them later on. But I want to walk you through just quickly the vision. I'm a visual person. I have to see it. I have to touch it. I have to see it in 3D. So just so you get an idea of what we're trying to do, this is not something Planning Commission that we've run through by the city. This is just for us to get an idea of what we would like to see, what we expect this place to feel like. So as you know, it's a fine building. It's structurally sound. It's a brick building. It's a little bit modern. It's got this nice green space out front, but what do you do with it? It's an empty green space surrounded by prickly bushes that are not friendly. You don't want to walk by them. You don't want to sit in there. There's no place to sit. So that was the first thing when it came to the look and feel of this building that we wanted to change. So this is just a little bit of a mock-up of what we could anticipate. First of all, we want to identify the... I can't tell you how many times people have driven by this building and they say, you know, I didn't even know that was there. What building are you talking about? I have no idea what you're talking about. And so what we want to do is draw attention back to this building. So first of all, I mentioned the mixed use. This is a storefront. This is right on Lawrence Street. So there's, if you imagine everything that's north of Park Avenue, this is what it is, and this is an underutilized and a little bit institutional-looking storefront now. So what we hope to do is make it inviting, maybe have right there, that actually shows retractable garage door slide-ups. Those would serve as both a storefront and inclement weather, but then if the weather's nice, you could open them, and it would actually be an open-air coffee shop. There's three windows. Actually, I have a little pointer here. These windows carry along. These overlook the existing park. But what we were planning to do is actually cut some of these short windows into French doors and have the coffee shop open up, or say coffee shop, might be a restaurant, who knows what it's going to be, but open up into what would be a plaza where there could be dining. This, I hope I have a picture of this. I might go back for just a second if you can bear with me. This park, in a conceptual landscaping plan, this plaza, this is a semicircular plaza where 90% of the time there might be dining, but on a Saturday night or a Friday afternoon, there might be a live music. And then these are actually retaining walls that step up back into the park, and they're really low, but it basically creates a mini amphitheater that during the day and when it's not using, it's beautiful, it's landscaped. But if, you know, I keep thinking of all the arts that are happening in Aiken. You've got Juilliard. You've got all sorts of things going on. What a great place to have an event right in the heart of downtown where you could seat probably 100 people or more if you really packed them in there. And it could, you know, alternate between these uses. And that's the idea, is that no matter what's going on, there's always something that could go on in this space. So to the mill itself, this is just a small version of the floor plan, just so you get an idea. But if you came in the elevator, the first thing you'd see is a storefront that provides space for the USC Aiken and SBDC. So they're going to be on site at the mill, a presence amongst these tenants and these businesses that are trying to get started. All the rooms in this red are what I would consider a micro office. These would be your 1 to 2 person offices. In the purple, these are, right now it's flex space. They're just wide open rooms. But these would probably, if I had to guess, would become the 5-person to 7-person offices. So they could be subdivided in any way. This goes back to the flexible space and that sort of thing. And then right in the middle is what would be the co-working space. They might have their own lounge in there, a little meeting space, that sort of thing. And then the lobby, conference rooms, bathrooms, kitchens, these are all places they share. And I would encourage, if anyone would like a tour, I'd be happy to do it at any time. It's a lot easier to see in person than it is on a two-dimensional map. And then back to the retail, this whole place is going to have a very polished but hip and urban vibe, something that I think has been toyed with in Aiken a little bit. It won't be too rustic, but it will be fun. It will be... a little bit bare bones. Upstairs there's exposed duct and there's exposed brick walls and that sort of thing. And I think it will be a place that people are actually proud to do business and to bring people into their offices to conduct their business. So right now we're scheduled to open in early April. We're working on the website now, but what we're doing, Small Business Development Center and the university are helping us, and it's actually a finalized version of what would be a application for businesses. Pretty much any small business doing real business and wants to do real business would be approved, but it gives us an idea of the sense of the mix of tenants. Are they a STEM type business, which we're seeing a lot of? Are they more of a marketing or PR consulting type business? And it kind of gives us the ability to get a broader view of what these businesses will bring to Aiken. And that concludes my presentation.
Katie, how many people did you say were in there already?
There's about 33 people on the first floor.
33. How many businesses would that
That's be? One business.
One, okay.
So they're an existing business. And then on the upstairs, I think we'll have anywhere from probably, not counting the co-working space, because I think this is a little bit different. That might just be program space, but true businesses that are seeing customers come in will probably have anywhere from 13 to 16 businesses.
Very good. It's exciting.
Thank you.
Say the least.
Will the USCA can Small Business Development Corporation be able to assist the businesses that are locating there, and is there costs
right
for their assistance?
Well, the Small Business Development Center, I should let Laura speak to that, but they are they're not fee based, so you don't pay for their services. I don't want to misspeak, but it's actually state funded.
Yeah, actually, it's funded under the auspices of the SBA.
Laura, can you come up here? We have to get you on the.
But not
recording.
Only are they going to serve the people that are working at the mill, but they'll be open just like they're open anywhere else to any business. So any business could come in for help or for guidance or workshops. That's one thing I failed to mention is the university is working now on a small business owners forum. So this is a place where any business owner could come in, feel comfortable, maybe just have a dialogue. It might not be a presentation or anything formal, just a casual opportunity to connect with other businesses. And those are not strictly mill businesses.
Okay. Thank you. I'm happy to be here and certainly happy to be working with Katie and her father on the project. It's very exciting. The Small Business Development Center.
Tell us who you are. We have to give out the recording.
Tell
us who you are.
I'm sorry. She said it. So. It's Laura DeSano, and I am at the Small Business Development Center.
At
USC Aiken. It happens to be the top performing small business development in the state of South Carolina this year. I'm going to put in a little PR here. Just nominated for the Regional Center of Excellence in Innovation. And I would say that working with Katie and her dad on this project, as well as the chamber and SCORE and the university, is an example of that type of innovation. What happens is the SBDC is funded really through the Small Business Administration. Dollars come into the state of South Carolina. If the state matches those funds, then we have access to them. In addition, we are funded by county council and other, you know, little private folks who help us a bit with offering some of our courses and so forth. And the university provides us space and kind. So when I look at this project, I see something that combines the best of education, business in the private sector, government, you know, city government, and the business community. And so that is really those forces coming together. In terms of what the SBDC provides, we are noted for providing technical assistance, which means helping new entrepreneurs, emerging entrepreneurs, develop their business plans, their financial projections, and figure out how to be sustainable. What that does for the state of South Carolina, but more importantly here in Aiken, is we help startups to form, we help jobs to be created, we help jobs to be retained, and we help those businesses secure capital from banks or private investors. We were 300% of our goal last year, helping small businesses in Aiken County to acquire $4.5 million in funding. So we will be valuable, I think, to this site because we'll be on site there. We will be able to ensure that we help those small businesses receive the technical assistance they need in order to succeed. Business is risky. There's never a guarantee for anything. But I think with our support and the support of the Chamber and SCORE, we can ensure that, you know, these folks will have the best shot at succeeding. We will be looking at a lot of businesses with innovation.
STEM businesses, science, technology, engineering, and math. We've got a lot of scientific types that are out of work that can do things like bring patents here and unique things to our city, you know, to really help to develop it economically. And I should note that people look at SBDC as, you know, for new businesses. 40% of our clients are new businesses, 60% are existing businesses. So if I can say so, he might have left. No, he's over here. Charlie Hartz, he's a client. You know, Katie, when she first came in, you know, we took her in as a client. So we work with things that succeed, and I think that we will provide the support to those businesses that they need to have the best shot at succeeding here in Aiken. So that's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Laurie, I want to applaud you, but Katie, you did an excellent job with your presentation, number one. Secondly, so you're so young with your innovative ideas. I know you had some help with your dad, but what I view is you're being so receptive to call in a more mature generation for expert help. That's the David Jameson of the world. And some of the others, but all that blended in, what emerged was your creativity, and it seems like every time you look at the plan, you're embellishing it more. But I also see more young people probably being more inspired. They had a dream to do this. They didn't know how to get started, so you've afforded them an opportunity to have a space, and with the help of the University of South Carolina, they can help to build upon that, those dreams. So this is great. Most of all, I'm looking forward to so many people, young people coming downtown, which is the dream of AYP and that group, to see more infusion of that younger generation enjoying the downtown area and the things that we have to offer here.
That's right.
You can see it in the audience tonight.
Yes.
That's right.
Have it in your sacks out there.
Any other comments?
Thank you for your vision.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks, Katie. Excellent job. Under old business, item one, approval of appointments and discussion of appointees to various city boards, commissions, and committees. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you very much. At our last meeting, Councilmember Mary recommended the appointment of Linda.
You don't have to go now. Excuse me. Excuse me, Richard. Go ahead.
Yes. At our last meeting, Councilmember Mary recommended the appointment of Linda Purdy to the Arts Commission. That would be the at-large category, and if appointed, that term would expire April 11, 2016, and that's the appointment we have for approval tonight, Mayor.
Okay, sir. Do we have a motion and a second for approval?
I have a question, Mr. Mayor. Seeing as we changed the... we have now six districts and a mayor, do we still have an at-large? Shouldn't the person be appointed as a representative? What are you, six, right?
I'm six, yes.
Can you speak to that, Glenn? It's the way it's set up now, but we could... Glenn's got something for you.
You have to be qualified to serve on some boards and commissions, like the Senior Commission. We drew straws one time to decide who would have somebody from the business, somebody from medical, somebody from at-large, and that applies to some, but not all the boards and commissions.
How about arts?
And he just answered the question.
Bingo. All right.
On the Arts Commission, there's certain appointees that have to represent certain areas, the university, education, business, certain ones, and there are two or three, I think, at-large appointments that you can pretty much put anyone in those positions. That's what that means by at-large.
Glenn, I wonder if you could give all of us a list of those committees and that there is a special, from a certain area or something that you mentioned.
Would that be in addition to what we provided in the agenda packet, Mayor?
Well,
we've got that indicated.
Okay, let me state this another way.
Okay.
What committees, commissions, boards have a special, a person has to live or can't live or can live outside of the city?
That would be in the volunteer handbook. that we're preparing for April, then you have last year's book as well, and we spell it out in there.
How many are there?
I know the Design Review Board has specialty groups. We've got arts and commissions. Accommodations tax, that's right. Those come to mind, and we'd have to look at the book for detail.
Okay, do we have a motion and a second for approval?
I so move.
Second.
Okay, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Okay, nominees. Do we have any re-nominees, put it that way, for next...
I would only like to say that in my email that I sent out, I took the list where the city manager gave us and indicated that there were openings available in all of these, and if anybody was interested to contact the city clerk, and that would be a first step to start, because I know some of us struggle to try to find the right people for an appointment.
Okay, well I have two. I'd like to renominate Peggy Penland for Accommodations Tax Committee, and also Hank Moorman from the Board of Zoning Appeal. And I have another one pending, but in the
I have one. I'd like to reappoint Todd Lister to the Accommodation Tax Committee.
Okay, any others? If not, they'll appear on the next agenda, next meeting. Okay, item two, review employee survey and approval of online survey provider. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, thank you very much. This was a discussion that you had at your January 27th meeting. At February 10th, and I've included the memo again in the agenda packet, we talked about the employee survey. There was some confusion that I had, and I went back to the approved minutes from the January 27th meeting. The motion that was made was that the city manager would identify a qualified company to perform an employee research survey. And then there was some discussion about whether or not that would have to be approved by council. But when I look at the vote from the minutes, the vote was a qualified company be identified to perform an employee research survey. That motion was unanimously approved. And I've had a discussion with staff, as I've mentioned, the council before. We did a survey in 2008, and the department directors felt that it would help them in their operations if we could take that survey and resubmit it. We have found an online survey provider, that's SurveyMonkey. That's used by several statewide organizations, national organizations, to conduct these surveys. For $200, we can have a survey that covers the questions that we've provided to council as well in the past. And I think, I thought we had the questions. Yeah, we do have the questions provided. It's called an employee questionnaire, and it's approximately one page. Yes, sir. And, again, we can do that for $200. We did check with various surveying entities, and we contacted the local academic campuses. There'd be a significant delay if we went with the academic campuses. They're underway, and they wouldn't get around to anything till next fall, which we felt was an undue delay. When we talked with the private companies, they typically use online survey providers. Now, they're happy for a fee somewhere between $2,000 to $4,000 to analyze the results. But our understanding of the discussion by council is that you wanted the survey conducted, compiled, and then delivered to council for review. SurveyMonkey will accept all the input from the survey. They develop their own report. We don't touch that. So it would just be anonymous, and it would be compiled by SurveyMonkey and provided to us so we could share that with council and certainly with staff for review. So with the motion being the way it is, we're ready to go forward. I mean, we've got it all lined up, and Mrs. Davis is here, can answer questions. But we're ready to go as soon as tomorrow if council is comfortable with that. And, again, we just wanted to honor the discussion and go beyond just the mere contents of the motion to hopefully have this resolved so we could go forward with the survey.
A question. On page 150, it looks like there's a selection here within the...
Yes, sir. The, that's the $200, $204 a month, and it provides unlimited questions, unlimited responses. We didn't see any particular benefit in the gold or platinum service and believe the select service would provide what we need.
Mr. Mayor, when I made that motion, I think I recall using the words that this would be the same process as the audit, and the audit is chosen by council and delivered to council. I looked at SurveyMonkey as well. It was one of the companies that I've looked at. I have responses from two or three survey companies that I'm in the process of studying. And quite frankly, given the situation that we find the city in now, I was planning on recommending that we defer this item until we get back to a normal state of affairs. I don't think we have time to be worrying about surveys and so forth. With regard to the exit interview, as I mentioned to the city manager after the last meeting, the only difference we have, and well, let me say, the examples that we have certainly can serve if the city manager chooses to add to the existing form. I think the difference we have, and again, we probably should defer discussion of it, is that I think the survey should be done by human resources and not require a supervisor. And I think the city manager feels the supervisor should be there. I think the results of an exit interview would be more productive to the city if the employee were freer to make comments one way, positive or negative. But I think, quite frankly, we ought to defer these items until we get through this disaster situation.
And of course, we've been discussing this for several months. Per the directive from council in January, we did go out, we did do the research. I provided that in the agenda packet 2 weeks ago. I really haven't had any input with any specific information. As far as our exit interview questionnaire, we thought there was a helpful question that City of North Augusta included in their exit interview, and it reads this way: was the job properly described in your pre-employment interview, yes or no? And if no, how was it misleading? We thought that would be helpful information. One thing, too, that I haven't mentioned in our private discussion about exit interviews is that they're just resignation circumstances where the Human Resources Department Director is not comfortable sitting alone in a room with someone to do the exit interview. So to limit her to just her doing the exit interview, we feel places her in an uncomfortable position, and we would like the option of having appropriate folks in the interview. Even if the department director is in the interview, the department directors have shared with me, and I understand where they're coming from, they would like an opportunity to have one last discussion with the employee. They are not adamant that they be in the entire exit interview. We think it could be potentially very helpful to us, particularly with the North Augusta question. If the department director would have an opportunity to be in the room, then leave at an appropriate point and make sure that Mrs. Davis is comfortable finishing the interview and whether she has someone else, another neutral party in the room, so there can be a frank discussion. We certainly want everybody to be comfortable with the exit interview taking place, and we're ready to go forward with it.
I think my experience, and also I've talked to several other people that deal with HR for a full-time job, and none of them have any type of supervision as a backup, and I concur that there are cases that you may want a neutral third party, but I don't think a supervisor is a neutral third party. That can be another employee or an administrative type person in there, and mainly that's for the security issues and anything else that goes on as a witness. But I was in my own experience with two companies, the supervisor was not involved in the exit interview. There were third neutral parties involved, which was typically a designated administration type person. If the supervisor has a issue, they could handle that outside of the meeting. I guess I would I'm troubled by wanting to have the supervisor in there. And if that needs to be a separate exit interviews, I think that can be done. The supervisor can have one as well as the HR.
And that's the point I'm trying to make tonight, Mr. Edmund. I'm not saying that the department director would need to be, you know, the current policy reads department director, and I don't feel they need to be in there for the entire time.
Well,
I think you're saying the same thing. I think you're seeing two different meetings, though.
That should be two separate things. If you want to have a meeting over here, which in my own personal experience, I've done that with two companies versus discussing with other corporate HR people in the last couple of months. If anybody in supervision or the city manager on down or whoever, if they want to talk to them, that's fine. But once they do, they need to turn it over to HR, and the HR person is the last one to see them. And that's been my experience with, you know, very large corporations, which I've been in, and Ms. Price is in one of them, and Ms. Diggs is in a smaller one. But I don't think they should be two separate entities in total. And I don't disagree that the director or supervisor can have a meeting with them before that, but the last interview should be with the HR person.
I agree to that.
Yeah, and again, we don't have a problem with that approach. We do not. Staff and I do not.
Okay, but I think that's the independence you're looking for. And it would I think your suggestion would be well to have an administration person appointed to do that, so that if our HR director feels that they need somebody there, they can pick up the phone and call them to come in or meet them at that certain time. You know, it'd be a prearranged situation.
Yeah, and again, we would just like the flexibility of being able to understanding folks' schedules and scheduling. It'd be nice not to just have two people designated. We would like the flexibility of being able to have folks in the room.
As long as they're a neutral person and not a member of in the line of supervision. And, you know, you probably, in a lot of cases, it's an employee retiring or they got another job at a higher pay, and those go very well. But then you're also going to have the disgruntled employee that you've already alluded to with a neutral person in the room. An employee leaving in my past working career was just as important as the one you hire, because that person is leaving for a reason other than retirement, say to speak. So,
and we felt the North Augusta question goes to the heart of that issue.
Well, I think it's important to review the bidding. We're talking about an employee who has decided to leave the city for whatever reason. Could be a good reason, could be a bad reason. But I think we all should want to know exactly that employee's views on his or her employment with the city. It's a simple process. I sort of object with the supervisor being here, because I think that's going to be intimidating with the supervisor. But if we want to have a supervisor exit interview, an HR exit interview, well, that's fine. I mean, the whole point of the process is let's find out why we're losing that employee, because it's clear to, I think, everybody on council, we want our employees to stay with us. We hire them, we train them, we have an investment in them, and we should all be disappointed when we lose an employee for whatever reason. So,
I think Reggie's really hit it on the head. I think it ought to be a neutral person. And as you said, they can talk with their department head anytime. They probably already have. And if they want to do that, they can do that. But then the last one should be
I think that's pretty well standard. I'm going to use the word commercial industrial. I'm not familiar with municipalities, but I would suspect a lot of municipalities do it that way.
Yeah, that's why we provided it. Were there any other council comments on this?
Well, yeah, I had first on the questionnaire that we have. Was that some standard form that they had, or did we come up with these questions and all these things?
Okay, help me. Are we talking about the exit interview or the employee questionnaire?
Yeah.
That's based on what we did in 2008. We had about 100 responses to it. So as far as 2008 versus now, we thought it'd give us a good baseline comparison.
Well, my understanding of the reason for it is to try to help determine if indeed there's a morale problem, and if so, try to ascertain the maybe some of the causes. And so, number one, I sort of agree with Mr. Duar that if we ask these people how they like their job right as they're in the midst of overtime and hauling debris and everything else. Timing, the morale might be pretty low. Timing might be bad. And so it might make some sense to defer it temporarily. The other thing is that I think if we're going to do this and we are on the hunt for a question of morale, I think there might be some questions that might be better suited to get those answers. I'm not particularly in favor of asking what's your annual salary range, because that if somebody puts 60,000 and up, that sort of narrows down.
Pretty well tells you who it is.
Yeah, pretty well
almost
tells you.
And I appreciate that.
At least.
Well, I appreciate that. We're trying to find out entry level, mid level, supervisor. We're trying to get levels. We're not trying to identify people because that was helpful to us when we did the 2008 survey. I mean, there's as many different ways to do a survey as there are people.
Sure.
But
yeah.
Again, we've got a baseline based on 2008. We would like to start somewhere, and the department directors felt that using this questionnaire, since we have the 2008 baseline, would provide us a good comparison of then versus now. That doesn't prevent us from doing another questionnaire.
But you know, people are employed now, Richard, that were employed in 2008.
I don't have the exact figure. I'm sure it's at least half. I don't have an exact figure. Again, if I know what the questions are before the meeting, we can get those answers. I'll be glad to look it up.
With all due respect, I've twice told you that I was in the process of getting survey companies that I would get to you, and I'm still in that process.
And with all due respect, sir, that's been over a month, and I haven't heard anything from you. Nothing.
It hasn't
Zero.
Been over a month.
Zip.
It wasn't discussed at the last meeting. I had only one company.
You discussed it with me for over a month, Mr. DeWalt.
Yeah.
And again, I've said, please submit that.
Yeah.
We would like to address the concern of council.
Be second for that.
And go ahead and address this so this can be a completed item.
Okay, we've got a motion and a second to continue.
Do we have a second of our motion to continue this?
Yeah.
We have Ms. Diggs seconded.
Actually, he did.
And Philip did too, I think. Which one did first?
I did, but it doesn't matter. I don't need credit.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion? Show of hands, please. All in favor.
Okay. And I'd just like to put on the record, Mayor, that again, council's directed me to do something as the city manager, and I'm attempting to complete that action item.
Mr. Mayor, we also said we wanted to discuss this. I think it's important that my experience is a direct mail type thing versus using the city email, because the city email can be perused by anybody in the city.
Now, that goes to SurveyMonkey. We do not have access to that.
Do they use city emails or private emails?
It doesn't use email at all.
They can use either one. It's an account and it's an online survey.
Now, the motion only had to do with deferring the survey portion, but not the exit interview, or
only the survey portion. It's two different issues.
Yeah. Okay.
Exit interviews. As long as if we need to, do you need a motion for the exit interviews, or how do we want to manage that?
I don't. I think council's been very clear.
Okay. But we get a chance to once you get the procedure rewritten, can we have a chance to review that, please?
Mm-hmm. We can provide council with any information you desire.
Well, I'd like for council to get a copy of that just to see how it's set up with independent parties.
Yeah. I think we should, certainly. Okay, new business. Item one, first reading of an ordinance to advance the CPST 3 funds for Roslyn Park sewer upgrade.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of the ordinance is an ordinance authorizing borrowing from the City of Aiken General Fund reserve accounts as outlined in this ordinance for the purpose of funding sewer system upgrade in Crosland Park. The specific targeted general fund reserve account is actually the CPST 2 funds and general funds that are available. In effect, what we are doing is advancing the CPST 3 funds. The amount that we put in the ordinance is $1,608,319.50, Mr. Ebner called our office today and alerted us to the fact that back in October 14, 2013, we had come to City Council seeking $230,108 to cover the cost of the Boardman Road water line replacement as well as the Southwood sewer replacement. We obtained approval for that. We have not done an ordinance for that. So in order to clean up the housekeeping on how we're using the CPST 3 funds advance, it would actually be $1,608,319 plus the $230,108. That would make a total of $1,838,427.50 would be the actual amount that we would advance from the funds, and that would cover all three projects. I checked with our city attorney, since this is first reading, it would be appropriate to amend the motion to make sure that we have documented for accounting purposes all three loans. So for council action tonight would be a motion to approve on first reading with the addition of the Boardman Road and Southwood Sewer projects.
Okay. Plus what's already here, plus Crossland Park?
Yes, sir. So it would be Crossland Park, Boardman Road water lines, and Southwood Sewer.
Okay.
Of course, on second reading, if it passes tonight, we would make sure the ordinance was appropriately amended and documented.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
Yes. I'd like to.
Excuse me. Do we have a motion and second?
I was making a motion.
We got three hands going up.
He moved. She's
okay. Well, that certainly covers two.
I was going to add an amendment to it. I would like to amend the motion that's currently made that if you look at, it's going to be easier to put page 164 up. We have that sentence in there that says we would pay it at least by the conclusion of the 7 years, and I just we've taken that out before, and I'd like to take that out again. Can you put up one page?
You want to take out, but in no event later than 7 years?
It says the fund shall be repaid by the conclusion of CPST effective period, but in no event later than 7 years from the reimposition.
You want to leave in the words that say repaid by the conclusion?
Just be repaid just to be repaid when the money comes in. And you got to remember now, we've already committed $1.5 million at the end of this year, because we would have sufficient funds to pay for this as well as to repay the Crossland Park loan. So this gets us pretty well that we shouldn't be authorizing any more loans till after the end of the year, if you do the finances right.
So if I understand, Mr. Ebner, what you're saying is I want to make sure we present this ordinance to meet your concerns. The funds shall be repaid as funds become available?
As funds become available. That's what we used in back in October, because I got a copy of the minutes from that. And we also eliminated the interest on that, because we're paying ourselves interest, and maybe we're losing a little money, but I just we eliminated
that. About $10,000 to $15,000.
Yeah. Okay. So if you just eliminate that it'll be paid back when the funds come in, then that would get it equal to what we voted on in October.
Okay. And do you want to remove the interest sentence as well?
Yes.
Did I understand that?
We did that also. At least that was my understanding.
Interest shall be charged that the average month's interest is be stricken.
Yeah, the sentence that would be removed, as I understand the motion, is interest shall be charged at the average month's interest rate of the South Carolina local government investment pool as of the date of the loan.
Yeah, that would be removed. And we would pay it back as the funds come in. Because I think you'd mentioned to me today when we were speaking, our last payment was a little over $1 million, or about $1 million.
We just received a payment of a little over $1 million.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We did.
And if that keeps coming in like that, by the end of the year with this, the $1.5 million that goes back to Crossland Park, we would be on a cash basis. We would have paid off the loans for the other things, which I think is very appropriate.
I believe what I included in my memo is that we believe the funds would be sufficiently collected by April of next year, about a year from April.
Right.
We want to get that next quarter's payment in.
That's right. It would be then. So yep. If you could just...
I'll second the amendment.
Yep.
Well,
that's okay.
have a question. In George Grinton's memo, where he said the winning bid was $1,608,000,
yes.
He had also recommended a 10% contingency.
He did.
Is there some reason that we're not including that in this loan?
We would look at our other reserve funds, not the capital project sales tax, where we're borrowing money. So that wouldn't require an ordinance.
Okay.
Okay, we had a motion and a second before we got into this discussion.
Yeah, you got to vote on the amendment first.
Unless Ms. Diggs would accept the amendment.
That's what I'm thinking. Would you accept that?
Yes.
The change?
Oh, okay.
You accept the change? So we're all set? With the motion and second? Okay.
Just a quick question. The CPS 3 money for these two areas is broken out to $4 million for sewer and $4 million for stormwater?
No, I think the actual ballot question was $8 million for infrastructure improvements. Let's see. $8,095,000 for water and sewer system infrastructure upgrades. So it's not broken out in the ballot. We just did that as an accounting.
Yeah, that's an accounting issue.
All right. So, and you're tracking this. So this is the only amount off of that $8 million?
The two things are off of the 8 million.
What we're approving.
Oh, yeah, we have three things.
Three things.
Well, there's three issues.
There's three issues.
So that'll be on the yellow sheet you get.
Yes. Thank you.
We spent $224,000 as of the $330,000 as of the end of December. Okay. Yours truly is keeps the books here.
Are we ready?
Yep.
Show of hands. All in favor. Passes unanimously.
Mr. Mayor, I just want to add a comment to George and to Richard. And the appreciation for your accelerating this based on our Horizons conversation. Thanks so much for doing that.
Okay, item 2, resolution to approve mutual aid agreement with the City of Lexington. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of the resolution is a resolution authorizing the Aiken Department of Public Safety to renew a multi-jurisdictional mutual aid agreement with the Town of Lexington Police Department. We actually did work on this about a year ago. We found the ordinance, Mayor. We've had a conversation with the Lexington Police Department. They've been very clear that they need to renew these on an annual basis for their needs. And again, not that we're indebted to the City of Lexington, but they did help us with the storm damage and sent three crews down. And they say that this would be a good way for us to help them. And it's required by state law that council approve any mutual aid agreement. We would ask that council pass the resolution.
So moved, Mr. Mayor, that we do it.
Okay. Second. Do we have a motion and a second for approval?
I moved.
Second.
Okay. All right. I got one small point here. I think it's small. On page 173, it talks about the person that would go from one to the other.
Yes, sir.
And it refers to it at one point as a he.
It's a generic he. We could say officer.
That's what we should say, I think.
All right, Chief. Can you help? Oh, okay.
Right.
In paragraph B?
Well, in A.
Okay, well, it says B, too.
Okay.
So we'll change that to read the officer. Charles, if we'll just mark that and initial it.
All right.
We did not prepare the agreement Lexington.
Oh, I noticed that. Yeah. Yeah.
But we will make that change then.
Okay. Any comments? Any other comments? If not, show of hands. Please, all in favor? Passes unanimously. Okay.
That's all I have to present, Mayor.
Oh, okay. All right. Go ahead.
We have, do we need to rule on anything that the letter from Ms. Evans about the Planning Commission, or is that with information only?
Would you address that, Ed? I think you had some questions about electronic signs and a concern about the scope of what council wanted for planning commission.
I didn't know if that required. If this was information only or change, it was page 194.
It was just a concern Ed had. If you could just tell us, Ed, come up to the microphone, please.
The action agenda, which you approved last September, had an item to address electronic signs and the visibility of signs, you know, being blocked by trees, and the Planning Commission is working on both of those. But in a couple of recent City Council meetings, there was some mention of other sign issues that you might want to address. And my question was, did you want to address these other sign issues, or did you want the Commission to go ahead and deal with the next item on the action agenda?
Does anybody remember what these other issues were that they came up?
Do you remember it? Can you help remind us?
Election sign was...
Yeah, I expressed some concern about the election signs. I mean, can we find a better way to do it?
Well, and again, Mr. Smith may have a legal opinion about content of signs or whether we can regulate that.
We really like to prefer to address these as temporary signs. Signs that aren't going to be permanent in nature. And the signs you could see, think about are signs that advertise for political campaigns, signs that advertise the sale of real estate, all of that sort of thing. It's okay for your signage to address the time, manner, and size of those signs. It's not okay to talk about content. So when you point out we're doing this for political signs only, then you've restricted...
Oh, I have no intent.
I understand that. Yeah. But I do think it's appropriate to address overall temporary signage in the city of Aiken.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that.
We did not, though, have a vote from council on the action agenda item for that item, and that's why it had the concern if they were looking at the electronic signs, the Planning Commission should be looking at that, too. And again, you've given them the action agenda, so that would take a vote of council. Mr. Ebner, to your point earlier.
Yeah. So is that, Dick, you were only talking about the election signs only?
Well, temporary signs.
That was my initial comment, but apparently it has to be the temporary signs. So
I think what Ed's looking for is, do you want me to hold up the discussion about all of the signs, or hold up the discussion about the two signs that are on the action agenda with the other signage issues that could be a little more bogged down?
Yeah, these are two different things in my view. Electronic signs. It's not only the election, but it's a lot of little signs
sure.
that go up there.
Well, we haven't looked at this ordinance in I think like 10 years. So,
separate? I've actually suggested to Ed that I think it would be appropriate to bring in a guy who is actually a sign expert with all of the law that has come out over the years that deals with, you know, off-site advertising like billboards. Other signs, that sort of thing, but that's a much more longer, drawn-out discussion than just the digital signs and that sort of thing.
They've done so much work already, I'm assuming, here on the digital sign.
Yeah, I mean, we've had that expertise. I mean, I think they're ready to go on those signs.
Yeah, yeah, those discussions went well with the LED and the getting the trees out of the signs and stuff. I thought that went very well. Unless you got some feedback, negative feedback on that. I think that was pretty well all positive.
Well,
for the most part.
I think they're like, well, I don't, I won't.
Well, city manager said we needed a motion to do.
If you wanted to change the action item agenda, we've already given that to them. They've been working on it. So.
Why aren't they two different? What am I missing here? It seems like
different issues.
We're separating, or shouldn't we separate the two?
Well, I think
we hold up what has been done, throwing in these other paper signs, so to speak.
And we can do it either way. I mean, the process is let's do it once, and obviously doing it once, we're going to have to delay the Planning Commission to go back and look at the temporary signs.
We could
do the electronic signs and then separately go back and look at the temporary signs. I mean, we don't have an election until next year. That from the one vantage point, so.
Although you're looking at temporary signs in general, not just a sign with particular content.
I understand.
So you can certainly argue either way on the thing.
Yeah.
Maybe I suggest this. Could Mr. Evans put together a little memo for council and staff information what this would entail to look at temporary signs? Because the city attorney made a suggestion about how we might go about it, kind of like getting an expert traffic survey guy to do traffic surveys. Because that's something that would at least give us information what could be done.
Well, and again, in addition to what Gary has shared with council tonight, I'm aware from our managers' meetings that we do have specific consultants, and that's all they do is look at sign ordinances and they can advise, which could certainly be an action item for next year. You could handle this particular issue that they've talked about, the obstructed signs and electronic signs, and then do a comprehensive review if that's what council would like to see done as part of the next set of action items.
Yeah, that's the way I'd like to do it. By the way, I'll mention that this, I guess, is related. On the design review board, we had a wonderful lady from the State Department of Archives and History come down and do a presentation to us about signs. And it was, she was, I don't know that she was an ordinance specialist, but she was certainly a sign specialist, and she had a great slideshow program and talked a lot about it. And that, for the Planning Commission, might be a worthwhile thing if she could recreate that for them. And then, you know, some other consultants or experts that that might know the ordinances around the state better. But, you know, that alone opened the eyes of a lot of members of the DRB, and it might be helpful to the Planning Commission as well.
Nothing to prevent that from taking place. It's a good suggestion, even though it's not an action item. That could set the stage right. for it to right. be an action item.
Right.
Sure.
Now, I don't think we ought to hold up their conclusion on the LED signs issue.
I don't either.
Oh, no, I'm fine with that. So, in other words, when Ed finishes item 3 and 4, he'll go to item 5 on the approved list. Is that what Mr. Evans?
That's normally what Planning Commission would do.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
And there's a library bag for everybody on the council that we all forgot to take last time.
Oh, yeah. Can we close our meeting now, guys?
No.
Okay. We're adjourned.
One
are you, yeah, okay, thank you. I thought just me.
Okay.
All this running around.
I'm always hot.